Today's featured speakers are Mike Omero and Norman Frost-Vang. Each spent over 30 years with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at the Vicksburg, Mississippi facility and are now private engineering consultants after their retirement. Both have extensive experience in this area of dredging management, and you can read more in their expertise on biosketches. Now, before it over to Mike, who will kick off today's seminar, I remind phone participants again to put your phones on mute, and if you don't have a mute button, please hit *6. And again, please don't put us on hold. So with all that said, I leave it to Mike to go move forward. Go ahead, Mike.
Hello, everyone. I hope that many of you who were here last week are here for this week's session. I think we had a real big crowd last time, and I'm sure we do this time as well. My presentation is going to be the first of the two on environmental dredging, and you can see from the title slide, slide number one, that I'll probably start off with some general information, and then I'll be describing various types of dredging equipment that have been used for environmental dredging. I'll talk about processes, the various types of processes related to removal and things of interest to environmental dredging especially. Then I'll talk a little bit about dredging operations.
Hello, Mike.
And then touch on some conclusions.
Mike?
Yeah.
Could you speak closer to the phone, please?
Well, I got it right up to my mouth, but I'll try. Does anybody else have any trouble hearing volume-wise?
You sound okay here, Mike.
Okay, it may be just your connection. I'll be touching on all those topics. Going on to slide number two, this is a conceptual illustration of environmental dredging and the processes that are most important. There's a lot of similarities between environmental dredging and the dredging we think of for larger navigation projects, but you can see we have in this illustration, a dredge in the water. There's a blow-up of the dredge head down there on the lower left, and that's meant to illustrate the process of removal of the sediment and the leaving behind of some residual sediments. And then in the lower right, you see a conceptual illustration of a plume of resuspended sediment in the water column. And as a result of that resuspension process, some additional residual sediment can form by settling. And also, we may have release of contaminants directly to the dissolve phase in the water column. And depending on the type of contaminant we're dealing with and, you know, what the concentration is in the sediment, we may even see some releases of contaminants due to volatilization to the air. So when we speak of environmental dredging, the focus is more on these processes than it is just on the removal process and production in, say, cubic yards per hour like that we normally want to cover with environmental or with navigation dredging. Going on to slide three, the leading technical issues for environmental dredging include these processes of removal, especially with accuracy and precision, even more important for environmental than for navigation. But these processes of resuspension, contaminant release, and residual sediment, those three R's plus the R or risk compose what's called the four R's. Now, you'll see I've got five R's listed, but the reason I bring up four R's is because we had a very interesting and productive workshop a few months ago in Vicksburg at the Waterways Experiment Station. On the four R's of resuspension, releases, residuals, and risk. And you'll be seeing some very good papers, I think, coming out of that workshop. And a lot of the basic definitions and findings of the workshop you'll see in this presentation I'm giving today. But in addition to those R issues, there's the impact of debris, very important, and I'll emphasize that. Compatibility with, transporting the sediment once we've picked it up, rehandling it, perhaps treating it, and then, of course, always disposing of it or using it for some purpose. Those are important issues. But also we have some ancillary ones, dewatering, water quality issues, the effectiveness of controls, which is what Norman will talk about in great detail after my presentation, things like silt curtains. There are potential conflicts in performance standards, and I'll be listing those performance standards in one of my slides. We also have other issues, what we call dredging windows, which are seasonal restrictions, or in the case of, I guess, the window would be the open part, but certain times of the year when dredging would be allowed or would not be allowed due to some environmental concerns. That's also applicable to environmental dredging as well as navigation dredging. And we have now a newer group of issues that have come to light more so in the past few years, what we would call quality of life. In other words, things like noise, traffic, air pollution, lighting, for instance, things like that that might impact the nearby residents or communities or even industries around the dredging site. So all these things are really important issues, and we're learning more about them as we gain more field experience with these projects. There is some technical guidance out there on environmental dredging. Kelly alluded to the EPA Superfund sediment guidance, which a lot of the things in this presentation harken back to that. It's available on the web, published in 2005. It contains a chapter on environmental dredging and dredge material, the disposal of the contaminated sediments due to environmental dredging, dredge material disposal. It is fairly general level of guidance in that document, but some very good information. But we're also working to develop some more detailed technical guidance on environmental dredging. Things that I will be talking about in this presentation and Norma will be talking about are spelled out in this environmental dredging technical resource document or guide document, and it is at this point the status of that document. It is in the first stages of review by EPA, but we're hoping to make progress on that and get that out for a wider audience for review in the near future. So a lot of the stuff I'll be touching on is covered in that guidance as it's being prepared and finalized. Going on to slide 6. If we look at environmental dredging as a project, there are a number of, I guess you would call them design steps or evaluation steps. Everything from the beginning of initial evaluations and defining objectives to characterization types of things, selection of equipment on down through the list to the end where you might be developing written plans and, finalizing cost estimates and making a decision whether to implement this as part of a sediment remedy. And these steps are mirrored in the content of our environmental dredging guidance that we're in the process of preparing. And I'll be touching more on this as we go through on some of the major steps here. And the next slide on slide number 7, is a flow chart that illustrates these same steps plus a little yes-no logic and sequencing logic that goes along with evaluation of an environmental dredging project. And I think it's very important to keep in mind that these projects are this part of a sediment remedy, these environmental dredging projects, or that component of the remedy, is fairly complex, and there's lots of different things going on that need to be considered. And to do a proper technical evaluation and proper design and efficient design, things need to be done in a certain sequence, and there's a lot of potential for feedback and iteration, too. As we go through, that's what this design sequence is meant to illustrate. Going on to slide 8, one of the first steps in that sequence of evaluations is to define the objectives for environmental dredging. Now, we go through feasibility studies for these sediment remedy projects. We go through detailed plans. Parts of those documents are defining remedial objectives, but if you're going to be looking at dredging as a sediment remedy component, the dredging itself is going to have objectives associated with it, and that's what this list is all about. We want to dredge accurately, such that we remove the stuff we want to remove, leave behind the clean sediment, because everything we remove costs lots of money as far as either treatment or disposal. We want to do all the removal in a reasonable period of time. For most projects, if they're not really large projects, we would like to get the environmental dredging done in a dredging season, which might not be a whole year. So we want to get that work done in a reasonable amount of time or in a reasonable number of dredging seasons if it's a longer, more complex project. The third objective, we want to minimize or control the resuspension of the sediments during the dredging process and the consequential releases of contaminants. And you'll hear me say probably more than once that we can't dredge without resuspending sediment. We can't dredge without releasing some contaminants. But we want to minimize or control that. That's certainly usually an objective for these remedy components. And then associated with that, we want to minimize or control the amount of residual sediment, because if we have residual contaminated sediments left, that means either additional dredging pass or another control measure like the placement of a residual cover over the top of that thin layer, and that costs money. So the residuals, you're going to hear me say probably more than once, that is probably the one of the most critical problems associated with environmental dredging as a remedy component. Going to slide 9. Factors of importance in designing these projects. Site and sediment conditions, extremely important. Every project is going to be different because of the differing site and sediment characteristics. Project dredging requirements. What I mean by that bullet is how much dredging is required. Are we talking about a 10,000 cubic yard project or a 1 million cubic yard project? That's going to have a lot to do, for instance, with what the project is going to involve and how complicated it's going to be and what we're going to do to get it accomplished. Other things like water depth or dredging on slopes or dredging banks of waterways as opposed to the bottom, all those are, you know, project-related, dredging requirement-related factors. Equipment selection is a very important factor. If we choose to go, for instance, mechanical versus hydraulic, some basic issues like that can really drive how the project is going to be prosecuted and how successful it might be. And the second to last bullet, these projects are not as exacting as, you know, design of a structure. They're involving work in the water, which means marine construction. They're involving our desire to be very precise with what we're doing, but we can't see what we're doing. Lots of factors that are, you know, beyond the technical design as such, and get back to the ability of a contractor to prosecute the work and do it successfully and efficiently. And that has a lot to do with the experience and the skill of the contractor and even the specific dredge operator, for instance. So we've got, you know, a human factor. We've got a human factor built into this that's very important. Somebody needs to clear mute, please.
Yes. Again, as a reminder for those in the audience, please put your mute, push your mute button. And if you don't have the mute button, hit *6. Thank you.
We appreciate that. And the last bullet on these factors of importance are performance standards. I've got a slide on performance standards, and that means essentially the rules that you're going to have to go by in getting this work done. Going on to slide 10, if you're looking at the initial evaluations that should be considered, this slide summarizes those. I think it's very important to, first of all, in visualizing a removal remedy where dredging is a component, you got to remember, and it's always, you got to keep in the, you know, front of your mind, that the dredging and excavation is only one step in a, you know, what some people would describe as a treatment train or process train. Once we pick it up, we got to do something with it. We got to rehandle it. We got to transport it. Then we have to treat it, dispose of it. And the cost of doing all those subsequent steps and how well we can actually get it done is relying on the dredging and vice versa. So the compatibility between the dredging component of the remedy and these other components of staging, rehandling, treatment, disposal is very, very important. It's very important to keep the dredging in mind as a component of a removal remedy. There are certain advantages and disadvantages of dredging, and you can look right in the EPA sediment guidance. There's a nice table in there that gives those advantages and disadvantages. That's something that should be considered in your initial evaluations of whether you want to include dredging as a remedy to evaluate, say, at the FS stage. And I would say fairly that that it's commonly accepted that dredging is going to usually be evaluated for almost every sediment cleanup project. It's going to be evaluated as one, you know, one option. So usually we're doing these environmental dredging operations for practically every sediment project that we encounter. Site and sediment conditions conducive to dredging are very important. Things like, you know, fairly shallow water depths, fairly manageable thicknesses of sediment, that type of thing, very important to consider initially. And it's important at the early stages, too, to, you know, find the constraints that are really critical. Like, do you have disposal sites available somewhere nearby your dredging area? Do you have shoreline structures that if you dredge deeply into the channel sediments, or shoreline sediments, you have the potential to undermine and fail them. Do you have a hard, you know, a rock hard pan layer right beneath your contaminated sediment layer? Or do you have lots and lots of debris in the sediments? Those are major constraints that really will drive how you might go about dredging or even whether dredging is feasible down to a certain, say, elevation or whatever. So it's important to identify those up front as you begin your detailed site investigations. And then from all those, you can then determine the applicability of dredging as a remedy approach. Going on to 11, this is a list here of the major questions we would look at or major topics we would address as far as site characterization for environmental dredging. Access, navigation, what the background conditions are. You see that word debris. You're going to be seeing that debris and debris over and over again. Things like slope stability considerations, and then also things related to logistics. Are there areas close by that you can stage for rehandling areas or disposal areas, or are there, you know, available routes or effective routes for moving barges in and out or laying pipelines? All these things are critical issues for site characterization. Going on to slide 12, when you start thinking about those issues, these are the kinds of things that you likely would include in a site and sediment investigation program, things that you might even be very wise to consider at the RI stage of a project. I've seen many, many projects, some of them very large, where the RI was done and all these decisions are being made on very little data. And when it gets time to really start looking at the remedy options, we usually have to go out and get more data. And there's a lot of things that you can do in planning your remedial investigation that will help you in the next stage you know is going to come, the feasibility study, and you know you're going to be evaluating dredging. So you might as well get some of this data as early as possible. And this lists some of the tools that you might use. Coring, extremely important for sediments. It's important to pair physical data and chemical data on the distribution of the contaminants. It's important to get almost everything you can think of in the way of characteristics of the sites to define the extent of debris, what the sediment layering is all about, you know, relying on old records as well as the new borings you might take. All these things are very important, and there's lots and lots of tools out there to do that, and usually we will throw everything at it on a big project. We'll throw everything at it that we can to get as good a picture of what the site conditions are like and the sediment characteristics are like. Going on now to slide 13. Debris. I've said it four or five times already. If you have lots of debris in your sediments, it's going to really drive how efficiently you'll be able to dredge, and it usually will drive the issue of looking at hydraulic dredging versus mechanical dredging. You'll see that that mechanical dredging is really the way to go if you have lots of debris in the sediment, because you'd have to separate it all out anyway. And it's important also to look at debris with depth, because if you see it on the surface, chances are it's with depth down to probably the layer that you're interested in removing. So you may have to even look at multiple debris removal operations as a separate operation if you wanted to do, say, hydraulic dredging. On the other hand, if you do mechanical, you'll see that you might be able to get all done at one time. Going on to slide 14, I mentioned performance standards. These are the more or less rules that you may have to abide by to get the dredging done. Of course, we're going to have an action level, or cleanup level. That's going to define how deep we dredge and over what area we have to dredge. But there are these ARRs out there, things like water quality standards or other regulatory standards that would have to be met during the project. As far as production, some of these projects have a time limit. I'll give you a good example, the Hudson River project. Somebody at some point years ago said this project has to be done within 5 years. Well, so, you know, that now sets a time limit for production for us, and we then start evaluating dredging options with enough equipment and enough production rate to get this work done in that five-year time frame. Of course, on production, if you have a smaller project, I think I already mentioned that you may want to try to size the dredge and the production rate so that you can get a smaller project completed in one dredging season. That's usually an important consideration. Resuspension and release, the water quality standards, and maybe even air quality standards, and their points of compliance are very important performance standards and would maybe dictate the size of equipment or the type of equipment. Residuals, as far as performance standards for residuals, usually that is tied to meeting the action level at the completion of dredging within, and some point of compliance maybe even for adjacent migration of residual sediment. So that goes back to the action level usually, and usually it's a surficial performance standard. And we may have also standards on quality of life, things like limits on the times we dredge because of light or noise or whatever it might be. And I'll mention here that depending on how your evaluations match up with these performance standards, it's going to dictate whether or not you need control measures like silk curtains. Going on to slide 15, I'm breaking at this point the sort of general stuff and now going to focus on equipment selection. We need to select the equipment at several stages along the way. Usually first in the feasibility study, we'll select equipment to evaluate options. In remedial design, we may be focusing on, you know, a specific project and then select equipment that might be the most appropriate for the final, you know, project options we're looking at that we've selected for design. And then once again, when you get ready to implement, the contractor may come at you with some considerations for equipment selection. A couple of key points. There's a lot of equipment out there that will do a good job for environmental work. But not any one single equipment type or manufacturer or, you know, design of a dredge head. No one single type of equipment is best for everything. You have to select the type that matches up best with your project and your sediment conditions. And the selection depends on a number of factors, and I'll get into that in the next slide, but it has everything to do from objectives to the specifics of the site and sediment and what the equipment capabilities are. And then lastly, the selection of equipment should be evaluated based on field experience, and we're getting more and more of that every day, what predictive tools we have available, and we may even rely on field trials or pilot studies. And I recommend those. I think for very complex projects, that's probably money very well spent to do pilot studies. I'm now going to go to slide 16, and this is a list of equipment selection considerations. Once again, what your goals might be as far as meeting certain standards, that's going to dictate equipment. What might be termed the inherent capabilities of equipment, things like how deep a certain dredge type could go, or how it might be operated and be operated in a way, say, to reduce resuspension might be a selection consideration. And then, once again, the most important usually is the specifics of your site and your sediment, and how that matches up. And the key questions are usually mechanical versus hydraulic. That's a basic question that is you're really going to come up right away for almost every project where you begin to evaluate what type of equipment. Should I go mechanical? Should I go hydraulic? Another issue is conventional versus specialty, and I'll define what those mean, but lots of different dredges out there, some of them very unique and difficult to acquire. Lots of dredges out there that are very common, and you need to decide, do you need to go specialty or can you go with a more conventional type? And then the size and number of dredges. That relates back to any constraint that you might have on production. Smaller dredge sizes are usually used for these environmental projects compared to the size of dredges that we see on navigation projects for a number of reasons, usually related to resuspension, but also sometimes related to the thickness of sediment that we have to remove. So usually we're working with smaller dredges. And then the last issue there on selection is that you might have more than one dredge type out there to get the job done. For instance, you might have one dredge to remove thicker production cuts, and you might have a separate dredge type, or maybe separate bucket types or whatever, to do cleanup passes or certain parts of the project where the thickness of sediment is much thinner. So you're not usually bound by one equipment type, but this is a contracting issue and a cost issue also, but you can consider, of course, multiple dredge types, and the contractors can do this. The next couple of pictures, slide, 17 and 18, these are pictures that illustrate the categories of equipment types that we have identified as the most commonly used for environmental work. And this harkens back to some guidance in the Superfund sediment guidance some guidance on equipment selection, where we have listed a whole laundry list of selection factors related both to the inherent ability of equipment and to the how equipment matches up with site conditions. And we've done this for each of these major equipment types. And I'll be touching on some of the more familiar ones, but you've got your mechanicals lined up there at the top, conventional clamshells, enclosed buckets, and articulated fixed arm types of dredges, and then the more common hydraulics or the cutter heads and the horizontal augers. There are also a number of different plain suction dredges. And then you start looking at pneumatic and go to the next slide on slide 18. These are the more specialty dredges listed. Also diver assisted, you know, you may even use divers to do cleanup passes, but, you know, once again, if you got to bring a diver out there, you're getting pretty desperate usually, but they have been used and they have been used successfully, but they're very expensive, lots of safety issues and lots of efficiency issues associated with that. Going to slide 19, I'm going to start at this point talking a little bit about some specific dredge types quickly. Clamshells. These are the most common mechanical type of dredge used for navigation work, and they're commonly used for environmental work. You see on the left picture there with the red bucket, that is one of the cable arm buckets. The cable arms are, you know, have been used on a number of these projects. It is illustrative of the type of clamshell bucket that's normally considered for environmental work because it's a level cut bucket and it is a sealed bucket. And these are both operating characteristics that are desirable for environmental work. One thing about these types of buckets compared to the more conventional clamshells, they're lighter usually as far as their weight. Conventional clamshells are thicker steel. They cut in a sort of a hemispherical bite compared to these level cut buckets. But I'm not trying to say, and I'm not saying that the environmental buckets are always the equipment to use, because if you have very, very stiff sediments, for instance, the conventional clamshells have the advantage that they penetrate more easily and they're more efficient at removing the sediment. So there's always trade-offs, and once again, it goes back to the site and the sediment conditions and which type of bucket is most suitable based on those conditions. Going on to slide 20, these are some pictures of a couple of the fixed-arm mechanical dredges. One difference between these and the clamshells, you can see that these are attached to a fixed arm that is mechanically powered, pushed into the sediments. And so there may be, under the right sediment conditions, maybe more control over the level of the cut or the elevation of the cut face. And so there may be advantages there. Also, these are designed with sealed and level cutting mechanisms. This is the Bean horizontal profiling grab dredge that you see in the picture on the left and the lower one on the right there, close up of the bucket. But also backhoe type dredges can be used too. There's a backhoe up there in the upper right picture. Those have been used on a number of projects as well. But there's a basic difference between fixed arm articulated and the wire supported buckets, which have to rely on the weight of the bucket as far as controlling the level of cut and stripper sediments. A couple of the more common hydraulic dredges, the cutter head dredge. These dredges are probably the most common dredge out there used for navigation dredging. This picture here is a picture of the cutterhead dredge being used now on the Fox River remediation work for OU1 of the Fox River. And this is an articulated ladder, an articulated dredge where they actually can, instead of just lowering the ladder that you see, they also can adjust the angle of the cutterhead depending on the water depth. And that helps them dredging in shallow water, which is what they're dealing with in OU1, a lot of shallow water area. But these cutterhead dredges swing back and forth on spuds. They're usually pulled by anchors. Some of them are operated differently. But the sediment is essentially loosened by that cutterhead, drawn up into the dredge intake pipe by the hydraulic pump, and then pumped out through a pipeline. And that pipeline can go directly, say, to a treatment plant or to a diked area, or in the case of the Fox River here, it's being pumped into geotextile bags for dewatering, and then the dewatered bags are then later moved to a landfill. Going on to slide 22. The other more common type of hydraulic dredge is the horizontal auger dredge. This operation, instead of swinging from side to side, it is maneuvered straight ahead in a straight line by cable. You can see in the picture, both pictures, the horizontal auger itself is like a screw mechanism that moves sediment to the center where the hydraulic intake picks it up. They've been used in a number of projects, very common. They cut a path. They have some advantage in certain situations because they can cut a nice thin layer, and they're shrouded, which reduces resuspension to some degree. But they essentially work like the cutter head in that the slurried sediment is removed by the pump and pumped through a pipeline to either treatment or disposal. But both the cutter head and hydraulic auger have been used for, you know, any number of projects. Touch on specialty dredges here just for a minute in slide, this is 23. Usually specialty dredges are dredges that have been designed to accommodate a certain requirement. Many of the specialty dredges that we hear about have been designed specifically to reduce sediment resuspension or to dredge sediments hydraulically at a higher water content than normal. Some of them have features to increase, you know, their accuracy or their precision of their cut. And then some of them provide a specialized function. Like the dredge on the right there that you see is a dredge that was used just recently for a project where they were cutting along slopes. And most dredges don't cut along slopes. Most dredges cut level. This particular dredge has been designed to cut up or down a slope. And so I would classify it, for the time being at least I would, as a specialty dredge. There's lots of different variations of this. You can vary the design of buckets. You can vary the design of hydraulic dredge heads. In this case, improving the mechanism for a dredge ladder to allow the slope cut. All sorts of different ways that a specialty dredge might be designed. And you see them, you know, see new ones popping up every so often. So, you know, I'm not saying that these are required. Once again, you would only use a specialty dredge, I would think, in cases where a conventional dredge is thought not to do the job that you need to get done, and then you might consider this as an option. Going on to slide 24, what I'm going to do now, describe the various types of dredging equipment. I'm going to describe now the processes that are important, and this relates to the R's. I'm not going to talk about risk, but I will talk about the 3 R's of resuspension, release, and residuals. But I also talk about production and accuracy, and I'll do it in this order. Going to slide 25. Production. We need to think about production in a couple different ways. There's one production rate, and usually that's expressed in cubic yards per hour, that is the rate that the dredge is capable of moving sediment while it is actively operating. And I would describe that or define that as the operating production rate. But then there's another production rate, and that would be the sustained production rate. And that would be the one rate that you would consider effective over a dredging season. And the reason I say dredging season is because we would have certain factors that would influence how many hours per day we might dredge. There are certain factors that would influence perhaps how many days of the week that we might dredge. And then I mentioned already the fact that we may have dredging seasonal restrictions that would influence how many weeks of the year we might dredge. And so the sustained production rate, in my mind, should be calculated or expressed as how many cubic yards per hour or day we can dredge, and over a season. It would be a reduced operating production rate that takes into account all those factors, and we then can calculate how many dredging seasons it would take a given dredge size to get the work done. And that's why there's a very, very important difference there. Lots of ways to estimate production rate. There's some programs out there. Some of them are publicly available. Some of them are very proprietary for different dredge types. But the key is you've got to determine how long it's going to take you for a given dredge size to get the work done, and that will likely influence the size of dredge or the number of dredges that you will bring to bear to get the work done. Also important to production is system design. A system for a mechanical is pretty simple. It's bucket size, cycle time, things like that. But when you're talking hydraulic, depending on how the site is laid out, the whole system has to work right. For instance, if you have a long pipeline run from the area you're dredging to a processing site or a disposal site, you may have to have booster pumps, and you may have to worry about static heads and how much head loss you've got and any number of factors that will dictate what that dredging system looks like. And all that comes into play in determining how efficient the dredges are, how many of them you'll need, and how large they've got to be. That's slide 25. I'm going now to 26. Some constraints on production tied to environmental work, especially is, how thick the cut's going to be. Is there debris present there? How fast can a dredge advance? Are we going to have silk curtains around it? Are we going to have to move dredges in and out of silk curtains, for instance? Those are constraints on production related to operations. There may be other constraints related to rehandling or treatment. In most of these environmental projects, the experience has been that the real bottlenecks are not at the dredge. They're at the either treatment site or disposal site. And those have got to be factored in. In fact, that ought to really come in just as much into play in selecting dredge size as what the dredge itself is capable of doing. And then you have other constraints on quality of life. For instance, there's somebody else that's got a mute button that's off. Please, everyone, again, put your mute buttons on, if you would, unless you need to ask a quick question. I appreciate that. Quality of life. If we're going to be constrained from dredging at nighttime past 10 o'clock at night because we're going to keep people awake, that's going to influence directly your production rate, your sustained production rate. In general, the production rates for environmental work have been low compared to navigation dredging using the same size of equipment. That's just a fact of life. They're going to be low because you're going to be taking more time for positioning and all those other kinds of issues. And another thing to consider in looking at production rates is that up to this point, we haven't dredged completely a Fox River or Hudson River. Size of project. Most of the projects completed to date have been fairly small. I think we've got 1 million yard project or maybe a couple of projects up in the 1 million yard range. But nothing in the neighborhood of, 50 million or 100 million has been dredged yet. So I think there's a lot to learn about production, from some of these projects that are, going to be coming up on the horizon. Going on to slide, 27. Removal accuracy. I'm talking now the accuracy of dredging, accuracy of removal. Of course, any environmental project is going to have the state of the art in electronic positioning. They should have it. And we can attain, precisions on the order of several inches. In other words, we will know where the face of the dredge cut is within a few inches. Using the state-of-the-art equipment and considering all the inaccuracies and linkages and slack, slacking wires and slacking booms and all that, we will know where that dredge head is within plus or minus several inches. And everybody's very concerned about precision because every inch means money when you're talking these projects. And so, accuracy and, the plus and minus allowance we have, equates to lots of money. I think of the second bullet illustrates something that's very important for us to keep in mind. I think the precision of us knowing where the cut is outstrips where we think the cut ought to be in many cases. Keep in mind that we establish where the cut line is going to be based usually on a series of borings. Those borings are inaccurate as far as where they, where we think the level of different layers really is because of a number of factors. You have core compaction, you have inaccuracies in the surveying of the cores, you have sometimes loss of material from the cores, and all that, when you start thinking about all those inaccuracies, I think we're at a point now with the accuracy of dredging where we are, really stressing our ability to characterize the site to the same accuracy as our ability to dredge the site. That's just my perception at this point. And that's now going on to slide 28. Start now talking about the first of the three important R's, and that is sediment resuspension. We can define that as the dislodged sediment, bedded sediment, that is dispersed to the water column. That's sediment resuspension due to dredging. We have some models out there that can be used to predict how much sediment will be resuspended by a given dredge size and dredge type. They're not perfect by by any means, but there are some methods to estimate this. And depending on the amount of sediment resuspended, that will determine your need for, perhaps need for control measures related to the resuspension. Going on to slide 29, some important points. All dredges resuspend sediment. All of them do. Some of them resuspend less under a certain set of conditions than others, and that may not be the only consideration, though, in selecting a given dredge type. Sometimes a sediment resuspension, you may be able to tolerate more if you get better production or less residual. So, you know, this should not be the issue that determines what dredge type you select for a given project. Models are available, and usually these models are focused on what's called source strength, and that is how much, say, in situ cubic yards of sediment per hour is resuspended into the water column by the dredge, or it may be expressed as a percentage of the cubic yards per hour that is removed by the dredge. Lots of field data have been collected on resuspension. It's not very consistent, and you can appreciate why, because there's so many different site conditions, so many different sediment conditions, so many different dredge types. Operators are different. Monitoring methods are different, so a lot of this data is just not consistent. But if you look at all the data, you can gain some general insight. And the field data, when looked at as one, you know, group of information, one data set, the resuspension rate due to dredge head resuspension, this is not due to other processes, but due to the dredge head resuspension, ranges from about 1 to 2% of the mass removed. And there's a couple of references that describe that. In fact, many references that describe that. If you look at other processes thrown in there, like barge, prop, you know, prop wash resuspension or resuspension due to moving silk curtains around, things like that, you know, the range gets larger, really. It really gets larger, up to maybe 9% when you talk about all these processes. But when selecting dredging equipment, usually you're focusing on what the dredge head is doing. So one thing in our favor with environmental dredging is that the mass resuspended is not that great compared to the mass we remove, which is a good thing. Placing resuspension, you should place it in context with other sources. If your calculated resuspension rate is so many cubic yards per hour, you need to look at how that compares to how much sediment is resuspended when, you know, a one-year thunderstorm, you know, one-year rainfall event occurs. Does it resuspend a lot more sediment than a dredge would? Well, I would think that would be an important thing to put in context there. Or is your project located right next to a navigation channel where you don't have any control of the ships going up and down the channel, and they're resuspending the same sediment that you're trying to remove? Those are important things to consider as far as putting in context. Another important point is that sediment resuspension is primarily a near-field effect and can be at least partially controlled. We can put a silk curtain around it. We can implement operational controls, so we can do things that reduce the resuspension rate. The question that should we do that or not is an important question, and we'll let Norman talk about that in his talk coming up. I'm now going to slide 30. As a consequence of resuspension, our attention usually turns to the contaminant release associated with that. And we define that as the movement of contaminants from the pool water in the sediment or from resuspended particles into the water column. In other words, how much contamination becomes dissolved, essentially, or maybe released as colloidal fractions. We can estimate that based on a number of lab tests, things like the DRET test that you probably have heard of, the dredging eluterate test. Also, if your sediment and concentrations are critical maybe to volatilization, there are some volatilization laboratory tests that can be conducted to look at the relative amounts of volatilization you could expect. But in all cases, you're going to compare those things to the standards that might be performance standards of the project that may be directly ARRs, and that comparison will determine the need for controls like silk curtains or operational controls. Slide 31 is some other considerations related to that. Resuspension is what causes contaminant release, usually. There are some contaminant releases for ambient, but resuspension is what we're usually focused on. The resuspension of sediment is a relatively near-field effect, But dissolve releases can be a far field effect, and they're not held in by silk curtains. So the contaminants that are released in dissolve phase should be looked at differently than the resuspended sediment particles. In general, we've been able to see that contaminated sediment can be dredged without excessive release. Now, that would not be necessarily the case if you had NAPL present or some very highly mobile contaminant. But usually we're not dealing with those contaminants. We are with some projects, but not with many projects. And if we can control resuspension, we can control release, because usually they're directly linked. I'm going on now to 32. Residual, the big R, in my opinion. So much attention has been focused on sediment resuspension over the years, and this topic of residual sediment has really only come to the fore greatly in, say, maybe the last 5 years, perhaps, or somewhere around that. It really wasn't even on the radar screen maybe 10 years ago. But residual sediment, I think, is a more difficult problem to overcome and deal with on environmental dredging than resuspension is and contaminant release is. Resuspension is defined, and these, by the way, these definitions are the ones that were crafted during this 4Rs workshop that we had. But residual is defined as the mass and concentration of contaminated sediment remaining in the area dredged after completion of dredging. And it's important to keep in mind that there are two types of residuals. There are generated residuals, which are the residuals that are essentially resulting from the dredging operation. In other words, we're saying we're removing a certain layer of sediment. You're going to leave behind part of that layer that you have touched with that dredge. And those residuals are the generated residuals. The other type of residual is what you would describe and what we define as undisturbed residual. And that comes from the fact that we might set the cut line with the equipment at a certain elevation, thinking that we will remove all the contaminated sediment, but because of inaccuracies in how we dredge or inaccuracies in how we characterize, we may leave behind undisturbed residuals that lie below the cut line. And those residuals have to be dealt with as well. We can't estimate the amount of residual, at least generated residual, by our experience and some measurements taken at a number of sites, and the papers that I mentioned out of 4Rs are going to hopefully summarize that really well for us. It's commonly talked about that it could be related to the average of the sediment column that is dredged. But regardless of how we estimate it or how we account for it, it may determine the need, and you should be planning in advance on the need for control measures for the residual. Should I be planning on a residual cover after I complete the production dredging? Should I plan on cleanup passes to get this done? Going on to slide 33, a couple of other points. All dredges do leave residual sediment. Just like all dredges resuspend sediment, all dredges leave residual sediment. There's no standard predictive method, although we're trying to work on some that make good common sense. Another thing to consider is that field measurement methods used up to this point on residuals are not entirely consistent. It depends on how you define residual. It depends on how people have collected samples. It depends on how people have handled the samples, taken the cores, sectioned the cores, whether they threw away the watery part or didn't. All these issues are very important in determining how good a data set might be in our overall thinking on how residuals are formed and how they should be managed. Also, the last bullet, multiple cleanup passes have been shown to show diminishing returns at some sites. The little picture here is the Reynolds site up on the St. Lawrence, and it's like a poster child sort of thing where, like 10, 12, 15 cleanup passes didn't really get the job completely done. And I think our general experience has been that depending on the site conditions, if you have a soft bottom, you can do a lot better, but this site had a rocky bottom. And so if you're dealing with contaminated sediment over a hard pan, cleanup passes or at least multiple cleanup passes are not necessarily a good thing to consider. But you can consider other management approaches like residual covers or caps. But this talk is not about residuals management. It's about dredging, so I'm not going to get into a lot of detail on that. But there are things to consider and factor into your dredging design on residuals management. The last slide on the R's, the four R's are related to each other. I think I already mentioned that sediment resuspension spawns contaminant release and also spawns residual or is a contributor to residual. So if you have sediment being removed, you're going to resuspend some sediment. You're going to then, if you resuspend sediment, you're going to then release some contaminants, and you're then going to have some residual effects. So release is a function of resuspension. The higher the resuspension is also results usually in higher residual sediments. But on the positive side, the controls that we implement for resuspension will also be effective in controlling contaminant release to some degree. But they may exacerbate the residuals problem. Now, what am I talking about there? Norman's going to talk about silt curtains, but what I'll briefly mention, if I hem it in with a silt curtain, it's going to hem in suspended sediment, and that's going to cause more of that residual to settle inside the boundary of that silt curtain. This may or may not be a good thing. It may be something that you factor into the design, but it is a fact of life, and you should be aware of that as you, you know, say, well, let's put silt curtains around this thing. You know, is that necessarily a good idea? And the last R, risk, is pretty plain to understand that contaminant release and residual sediments increase risk associated with implementing the dredging component of the remedy. Going on to slide 35, I'm going to break into a little bit on operational considerations, in other words, how a dredging project can be implemented in an operational fashion. This is a slide that sort of, you know, briefly describes the principles of sequencing and defining sediment management units or dredging management units. The little picture on the right is a picture of a piece of the Fox River from an early version of remedial design, and it shows Thiessen polygons. In other words, every little black dot is a boring location, and the Thiessen polygons are drawn around those. And this is a very common way to start calculating how much sediment needs to be dredged or, you know, what concentrations are and how they're distributed. But dredges don't operate, you know, very easily dredging Thiessen polygons. There's a big difference between, you know, how you slice and dice the project in the RI and FS stage and how you might do it in a remedial design and implementation stage. So we need to start thinking in terms of dredging prisms and defining dredging management units that are compatible with the operational ability of dredges to remove sediment. Also, sequencing is an operational consideration. In general, if we have a riverine kind of a condition, we will always sequence the work, or should always think about sequencing the work from upstream to downstream. Also, we should be thinking about sequencing the work from upslope to downslope, because, you know, we have sediment migration. It wants to go down current and it wants to go downslope. So those are some pretty general considerations in sequencing the work. And then I'll talk a little bit about methods of operation and the need for an operational plan. Going on to step six, this is a real simple little cross-sectional illustration of the differences between what's called a neat line prism and a dredge cut prism. It goes back to those Thiessen polygons. The upper block shows a series of borings, and if you look at the desired cut line based on what the concentrations are of the sediment compared to, say, your action level, you might have a line that looks like that upper one. Well, once again, dredges don't operate very efficiently along those kinds of slope lines. So you take the same data and you look at the bottom one, you may consider something like this in defining a dredging prism, in other words, a three-dimensional, you know, volume of sediment that would be taken out, considering how the dredge normally operates in a level cut fashion. And then, of course, there are slopes involved, and those might be box cuts, and I'll briefly mention that. Cutting on slopes, we talk about box cuts. They're the type of cut that a slope would take, in other words, like an angle of repose. Box cuts are important because they actually can influence how much volume is removed. And you can see there's one photo there on the right, an actual underwater photograph of a dredge face, you know, the box cut left by a dredging operation, one of the few photographs like that I've ever seen. But there are some specialty dredges to help with this, but usually we work with level cuts and allow the dredge to essentially work its way up the slope using box cuts. Going to slide 38, another operational consideration is overdredge allowance. This is a term commonly used in navigation, but has also been used with environmental work. It's the amount of sediment that you're going to pay the contractor to remove that lies below where you would really like the cut to be. If you look at the little diagram down below, our required depth of cut is shown with the black line, but there's an allowable overdepth. And in general, these should be tighter for environmental projects compared to navigation projects. And it's based on what I've been able to decipher from looking and talking to lots of people with lots of project experience, the state of the practice is about 6 inches at this point in time. That's the possible performance specification we ought to be thinking about for lots of, most of the range of project conditions. And since the cost of dealing with the sediment is so expensive, as you think about how to write specifications to get the work done, you might think in terms of incentives and disincentives associated with this allowance, overdredge allowance. Incentives for as a bonus for minimal overdredging and disincentives as penalties for excessive overdredging. It can be very important. It can a lot of money involved with that. Methods of operation. I got a couple of slides that illustrate some kind of unique things that have been done as far as ways dredges are operated. This is this first slide on slide 39 shows the method of operation for a horizontal auger dredge used at the Manistique Harbor project up in Michigan. And it shows outriggers attached to a barge. Usually a horizontal auger is advanced by anchors that are thrown way out in front of it, maybe somewhere in the water body, maybe 500, 600 feet apart. And then the dredge goes between those two, but the wind can blow it off course and things like this because these dredges don't operate with spud. So this particular unique way of doing things, they put two outriggers on a big spud barge, spudded the barge in place, and operated the dredge back and forth between the two outriggers, which I thought was a very unique way of doing it and had lots of advantages. Also, they had divers operating here. I mentioned this was one of the projects where divers were used for cleanup work. And in this case, the diver operated the suction from the same dredge. They weren't separate pieces of equipment. There were handheld suction lines that were attached to the dredge pumps on that same horizontal auger dredge and used to do the diver work, which I thought was a pretty neat way of doing things. Everything that I've said on operations should be written down in an operations plan. Just as we might design a remedial project with a remedial design, once the contracts are in place, or even before the contracts are in place, the operations plan might be a basis of letting the bids out, letting the project out for bids. But a written operations plan is critical. It should define what your dredging prisms are, the sequence of the work that you would require the work to be done in, both horizontal and vertical. It should talk about the details on production cuts versus box cuts versus cleanup passes, required layback slopes for deep excavations. It should talk about the dredging allowances and why they're set where they are, how the equipment might be operated for certain types of equipment, and it all should be written in an operations plan, and both sides of the project should agree on this plan. And then, as part of the operations plan, or maybe as a separate plan, depending on how the project is written up, we need to have an operations plan. Norman is going to touch, we're going to touch on monitoring in more detail with Victor McGar's presentation in the third installment, but a few important points on environmental dredge monitoring. We have construction monitoring versus long-term. Long-term monitoring for environmental dredging may only focus on residuals issues, but the construction focuses on removal volumes, removal rates, and resuspension during the dredging process. Our chief tools that we would work with or work from on monitoring is bathymetry, and then also some instrumentation types of approaches to look at resuspension. And that might include instrumentation like ADCP or should be always include collecting actual samples of the resuspended plume from the work column. As far as residuals go, residuals can be sampled using either grab samples or core samples, but you've got to have a baseline to work from before dredging begins, and then post-removal residual samples. And as with the operations information, all the monitoring and management approaches and management actions that were derived from those monitoring data should be written up in a monitoring and management plan. In other words, you don't monitor unless you know what you're going to do with the information. So you need to know beforehand what I will do if I see a certain amount of residual, or what will I do if I see a certain concentration of contaminants in the plume at a certain distance downstream. What is my next step going to be? Am I going to monitor more? Am I going to slow the dredge down? Am I going to tell the dredge operator to go home? All these things need to be spelled out and agreed to beforehand before the dredge hits the work. And going to slide 43, basic conclusions. Environmental dredging is complex. A technically sound evaluation or design requires efficient sequence of evaluations and evaluation of all the processes that are important. The evaluation should follow a logical progression, but you may have to iterate. You may find that one finding causes you to rethink what you've done before, and all this needs to be laid out in the design of the dredging component. Implementability, effectiveness, and cost should be considered in determining the acceptability of the dredging design. Environmental dredging should be, this is my favorite conclusion for everything I work with practically. The exact selection of equipment, the exact way you design the project, the exact way you describe a monitoring plan, all these considerations have got to be project-specific, sediment-specific, and site-specific. And what I mean by that is project-specific relates to how much you're going to dredge, where you are, in other words, what the project looks like, volume-wise, area-wise, that kind of thing. Sediment-specific, of course, refers to how the sediment reacts to, in this case, a dredge. And then, of course, site-specific relates to things like the hydrodynamics of your site, the water depths, the wave climate, all those site conditions that would influence how the processes are going to play out. And then, last bullet, dredging design should focus on the project goal, and that is risk reduction, and you should always monitor to determine if all your goals are met. That's the last. Going to slide 44, that's a really mean-looking dredge. I doubt it's never been used for environmental purposes, but I like it, and so that's why I put it there as the ending slide. So, Kelly, I'm going to turn it over to you. I guess we have time for a few questions.
Yeah, thanks, Mike, a lot. Yes, we do have a few minutes for some Q&A now. So while those of you who are unmuting your phone lines, I'll go right to those who submitted questions online. One question, Mike, is, for performance-based hydraulic dredging contracts, should specifications include explicit requirements for dredge size, pipeline diameter, pump requirements, et cetera, or is it typically left up to the contractor to determine?
Well, my definition of a performance-based contract is the answer would be no. The performance-based contract would essentially lay out the requirements. In other words, lay out the rules of the road that you got to play by. What the objectives are and what the ARRs are, what the water quality standards are, and then you leave it to the contractor to select the equipment and propose a way to get the work done. Now, you might ask the question, well, why am I going to go through all this heartache to do this myself when I'm going to let it be up to the contractor in the end? Well, it's up to you as a designer of the project to understand that this work can be done for a certain amount of money, and to estimate the cost so you can go to the client or the government or whoever the work's being designed for and say, this is what it's going to cost you, and this is how it's going to work, and I know it will work this way. But with performance-based contracting, you essentially leave it to the contractor to either do it the way you think it should be done or to come up with his proposals, and then you evaluate those. So the answer is no. I think in general it's not a good idea to specify a particular dredge design or manufacturer, especially, that's not a good idea.
Okay. Is there, I guess we'll just open it to the people on the phone. Is there any questions for Mike right now? Anyone have any questions?
Mike, Walter Need. Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thanks for including those Manistique slides.
There's a lot of bad things I can say about Manistee, too, but those are a couple of good things I can say.
I know. I appreciate it. In general, particularly soft-type sediment, would you at least agree that hydraulic leads to less suspension than mechanical dredging.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily think that. I think you ask a pretty basic question. If that question had been asked to me 15 years ago, I would have said, well, based on what we know, in general, hydraulic dredging seems to result in less resuspension than mechanical. But I don't think that that's necessarily true today. I think that mechanical dredges can result in low levels of resuspension. And I think that, in general, that the levels of resuspension that we see are manageable for both approaches. I think it's more important to think about that as one factor among a whole list of factors when you start thinking about the basic question of mechanical versus hydraulic. In fact, I think issues related to what you're going to do with the sediment once it's removed are probably overshadow issues like resuspension in selecting hydraulic versus mechanical.
Thank you. And then you did have one slide that shows mechanical. If you do have any debris associated with your material, that obviously would increase your resuspension potential.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. If you have lots of debris in the sediment, you're facing a dual problem. You're facing the issue, do I need a separate debris removal operation, which has its own resuspension issues, or do I, choose to go ahead with the dredging like a mechanical dredge? And if you do the mechanical dredging without debris removal prior, you're going to have an increased potential for resuspension because the debris will not allow the bucket to close, for instance. And those are real problems. And if you have lots of debris in the sediment, your potential for resuspension is much higher than if you do not have debris in the sediment.
Mike,
brought out time and time again.
You might want to mention the effect of debris on residual also.
Issue. I think I already mentioned that, higher resuspension results in higher residual. And debris, once again, if a bucket doesn't close, for instance, you're going to have a lot of sediment falling back into the water column, and unless you're prepared to go back and do clean up passes or other management, you've got to deal with that debris. So, yeah, the debris is a bad thing to have in your sediment. If you've got to clean up sediment, debris is a bad thing to have in your sediment. No doubt about that.
Other questions, comments, Mike?
Mike, this is Steve Nadeau from the Sediment Management Work Group. Nice job covering a topic. On that last point, the other thing that's important to keep in mind is even with a debris removal program, if the site has debris in the first instance, you're probably not going to get it all. So it's a 4M during.
That's right. Well, that's, I think I mentioned that if you see debris on the surface based on side scan or whatever it might be, usually the debris is with depth. And if you've got a project where the removal thickness is great, six, eight, 10 feet of sediment you got to get out, likely you're going to have multiple debris removal passes to get it out. And that means more resuspension every time you do a debris removal pass. So that is the downside on debris, especially because it's not just a few things on the surface usually. It usually goes down to the full depth where contamination is.
Okay. Well, if there's one more question, otherwise we're going to go to Norm here next. Leave that. Anybody have one lingering question?
My name is Dana Davoli from Region 10 EPA. I'm wondering, have you seen many sites where they've actually monitored for dissolved constituents, to see if there are violations of acute water quality criteria and how that relates to suspended solids?
Yes. In fact, there are some relationships between sediment concentration like suspended solids and dissolved, but they would be very site specific. You can't generally say that if I have so many milligrams per liter of suspended sediment that I'll have so much PCB in the water column.
Right.
That would be a very site specific.
Yeah, because we're finding that it doesn't relate at all, and the models all suggested that you would not have violations of the acute criteria using silt curtains and all sorts of things, and we ended up having those violations.
Yeah, you can't rely on an estimate of suspended solids to give you an estimate of contaminant concentration. That's the whole purpose of doing things like a Lutria test and.
Well, no, we did all those
types of things.
We did all those.
Well, maybe your test data didn't match up with your conditions, or maybe there could be any number of reasons why you didn't get good prediction. But generally, you need to be looking at, dissolved as a separate fraction, and
mm-hmm.
it's going to be a long, far field of perhaps point of compliance compared to near field. And some of these projects, use TSS as an indicator of potential release, and then they may trigger, maybe more monitoring or more frequent monitoring or something
mm-hmm.
like that. So.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mike. Now we're going to go on to the next part of this presentation with Norman here. And again, I would encourage or ask that everyone on the phone please put their phones now on mute or hit *6 again as we go towards Norm. And so that one with Norm would start off as slide number 1 or B1 in the presentation. Go ahead, Norm.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm off of mute myself. Environmental dredging control measures is the topic of this particular part of the presentation. What we're going to do is cover about the first half of this presentation on measures for the dredging itself. And then I'd like to move into assessing the management associated with the rest of the process train that Mike alluded to, specifically transport, restaging or rehandling, and treatment and disposal. And just give you, this is an overview presentation, so it's intended to give you some ideas along the way of what you may or may not be able to do. If you move to B2, the next slide, we're really beginning to establish why do we have to have control measures. Mike alluded to it already, the 4 R's we talked about, resuspension, releases, so there's concern that we don't want to violate the water quality standards, as also had been alluded to by the previous commenter. This is done in conjunction with appropriate equipment selection and use of best management practices. There are many things perhaps you can do to limit the need for let's say, a structural solution. And the last bullet on this particular slide, I think, is very important in that we need to incorporate lessons learned. There have been a lot of cases where we have learned the good, the bad, and the ugly about control measures, particularly the good old silk curtains that we'll talk about in a few slides down the road. If you go to B3, we really need to control resuspension and releases, and also I reiterate the fact that release in the context of soluble releases is definitely not controlled by things such as silk curtains. So we have to be very careful when selecting control measures for those particular types of releases. And, of course, residuals are always a component of the dredging process. And Mike already stated that perhaps in selecting a measure such as a silk curtain or some other type of device that is to control suspended solids in the water column, it might contribute to concentrating those suspended material as settled material in the form of some type of residual. Slide B4 just gives you some indication of what we consider structural versus operational controls. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on structural. These I'll just show a few slides just to give you an idea of what they are in overview. But we'll concentrate more on silk curtains, screens, and so on to give you some better appreciation for what we know about how to use curtains or how we have not properly used curtains. Structural measures on slide B5 might include a cofferdam, perhaps a Waterloo barrier, could include on the lower left-hand portion of the slide a temporary dam, such as that shown here was at the Housatonic River, and even sheet piles driven into the bed sediments to provide a more complete control over the water column so that you don't lose sediment out into that water column. Next slide shows a portable water-filled dam. This was at the site up at Marathon Battery up near West Point, New York. Constitution Marsh, where they actually put this barrier out and filled it with water, and they dredged, removed the marsh from behind it. There were some problems with this installation. They experienced quite a bit of leaking, patching continuously some of the holes. So they had a high maintenance problem. And they did experience, obviously, ice punctures, and they had a lot of work to do to keep this operational, from my understanding. Next slide. Silk curtains and bubble curtains have been used. They've been used in combination with each other. If you go to the next slide, 8, you see an aerial view of all of these being used at the same site. They used a bubble curtain for an air gate to allow operational equipment, boats, to go in and out of the site. Silk curtain you can see on the inside, and then finally the sheet pile wall that was driven to isolate the site under remediation from the river site. There are some issues associated, obviously, with this type of or some of these types of controls. If you go to the next slide, the B9, you see the air curtain. It operates with compressed air through a manifold that is anchored on the bottom to create the curtain, the bubble curtain. In this particular case, it's my understanding from the project manager on this site that when they fabricated these particular manifolds, they had a 360-degree actual bubbling operation, which actually stirred up sediments. And then they tried to wrap the pipes with filter fabric, and those were caught up in the prop wash of boats and so on. So there are some problems. I'm not sure that there are very many sites where this is being used, but it just illustrates that you can use these, but there are potential problems associated with them. Must be factored in. Now, let's move to B10. B10 is going to be the heart of the control measures. It's what we generally know more about, because usually silk curtains are going to be specified in the contracts as a best management practice. In fact, most states that I know of have some type of management practice, BMP they call it, that requires silk curtains. Next slide, B11. Well, what is a silk curtain? Well, essentially, it's a floating device, normally, and it hangs from the surface down some distance. It can be completely anchored to the bottom, which would be called a full-depth curtain, or it could be a hanging curtain that is just off of the bottom, and that would be a suspended curtain. They can be fabric that is a vinyl, let's say complete sheet, non-permeable, or a permeable filtering type of curtain. They can be named based on the type of water they're put in, whether it's slack, medium, or fast curtain. The real issue gets down to whether or not these curtains need to be full-depth containment. And we'll talk a few minutes as we get into it about the pros and cons of doing that. But the purpose of a curtain is primarily to control the resuspended material, not dissolved material, but resuspended into the water column. So it's to keep it in within this confined area. If you go to the next slide, B12, you see a little schematic that shows the different components and how one would be deploy a silk curtain. You have a flotation system at the top, and obviously that's marked for navigation site, so people won't run into it, although that still happens. You have anchoring chains. In this case, you actually have a curtain that extends to full depth and that is anchored at the bottom. You either have some pipe or chain or some type of system that will keep it full depth. And that is to, and in this case, you're not allowing the water to flow under it. You're allowing the water to pass through, so it must be a filtering curtain. Next slide. If you're trying to incorporate this with a dredging project, you might have a mechanical grab mounted on a barge, and you can see in this picture that there would be a hanging curtain, perhaps, that could be extended either full depth or mostly into the bottom, where you would dredge inside. Although you still see there are some operations outside of the curtain where there's still some evidence of turbidity in the water column. So you would dredge through this operation, and then you would move it along with the barge. A lot more difficult if you try to circle a hydraulic dredging operation and then try to move a silk curtain with a hydraulic project, dredging project. If you go to the next slide, B14, we're looking at a different type of curtain. This is one that's anchored to the bottom. You can see it's called a standing curtain. Primarily seeing these, this is a picture from Japan, where there's an H-beam and the curtain and the floats are all fabricated, and then they are lifted and placed in into the site onto the bottom. And then the float is released, and this could perhaps be used as a method for perhaps controlling, let's say, residuals when you're trying to go in and remove debris, let's say, to keep the material in one area where you, so it doesn't spread in the footprint during the debris operation. Or it could be used in a baffle operation if you're trying to have water flow over it and then back under a hanging curtain that would extend part of the way down. Moving next to B15. We'll talk just a minute about delivery systems. I have a couple of slides. This is how curtains come. They come in panels, perhaps rolled up, delivered by truck, or can come in, and then unrolled and assembled on the deck of a barge, and then they're deployed down into the to the water way, and then the anchoring systems and so on are attached. Most of these are would be maybe made up in 50-foot panels or perhaps even larger. They could be assembled on the next page, actually from shoreline. You can see here in the guy on the left side assembling a curtain, and then they are deployed from shore. On the right side of the picture illustrates the fact that they're made up, in this case, on a pier, and then they're actually hauled out by boat and then deployed. And this is in a lake dredging project. So there are many ways of getting them out there. The next slide, B17. This slide illustrates the fact that in some cases, and I'll talk later about conditions under which you deploy silk curtains, high water conditions, fast water, and so on. This is a case where you need to anchor the curtain because perhaps of the a fast current, and you just need to hold it in. Anchors will not, traditional Danford anchors and other kinds of anchors may not hold the bottom very well. So you have a pile that are driven, and the curtains are connected. And you'll see this perhaps as a remedial measure of a curtain that didn't work that would come back in and drive either wooden or steel paneling. The next slide, there are specialty curtains. Gundaboom is a company that makes curtains, primarily filtering curtain, particle removal curtain, they call them. And this particular slide is used to illustrate the fact that they are controlling the floating as well as suspended material. These curtains are permeable, as I mentioned, and that brings up a point. You see a lot of material that's collecting on the inside of the curtain. One of the issues you're going to get into is a need as this material builds up, it's going to plug this curtain, so there will be perhaps a need to remove that material, to clean the curtain. There are ways of cleaning it. You'll have to, one, remove the curtain in many cases to clean it. Sometimes they have vibrations that they can go along and beat the top of the curtain and have it have the solids removed. I asked one contractor, I said, how do you clean a curtain? And he says, well, it's pretty simple. All I do is turn it around. Now that's that may be okay in some projects, but I don't think in many projects it would be acceptable. So cleaning and removing and restoring and redeploying curtains can also create some significant issues with what do you do with the suspended material behind it and so on. Now let's go to the next slide, B19, which is the Black Lagoon. It's a legacy project, actually the first legacy project in the Detroit River up in the Great Lakes. This curtain, actually they had two tries at this because the original solid vinyl sheet that you see being deployed in the lower left-hand picture actually was not retained in place. It was depths up to 30 feet, and it was very difficult to hold it in with the conventional anchors. So they actually went out and installed a filtering curtain as a secondary curtain on this particular project site. And apparently, I haven't seen any real data from this site on the inside-outside monitoring, but apparently it was effective. The issue was they had a high velocity in the river, and that actually wouldn't allow for the initial anchors to stay in place, so they had to go dry a pile and put a new curtain in. If you go to the next slide, which is B20, I wanted to summarize just a few case examples where we had some information regarding the effectiveness of curtains. New Bedford, they actually, during a pilot study, they built a small confined disposal site, and they deployed a curtain, and it was quite effective. However, when they went back and did the pallet dredging project within the site, and they tried to use curtain, they had a lot of problems with wind and tide fluctuation, and they actually decided not to use the curtain once it was ripped out, so to speak. Other project sites, you can see Messina was not very effective at all. They had to add piles and hold that in. That was a river velocity situation. Sheboygan and Halifax apparently were able to work in slack water and shallow depths and not a bad performance there. We are lacking a lot of information on performance of silk curtains inside-outside to really get a handle on under the matrix of conditions that these curtains may or may not function properly. So I do make a plea for some of you out there that have data. I'd appreciate receiving any information that you might send in. If you go to the next slide, which is B21, Fox River, SMU 5657, if you see the cells that are the first three, FJI down to USI, these are upstream of the dredging project through a period where they measured turbidity, and then the ones in red cells are downstream inside outside the curtain, and they basically show that there's very little effectiveness of the curtain, or very little difference really between the inside and outside, or upstream downstream, for turbidity. There again, I don't believe we have the soluble measurements, but this gets back to suspended solids control. So if you go to the next slide, B22, this sort of summarizes that data that you just saw. They had an evaluation of real-time turbidity inside-outside, and really it was fairly inconsistent and very few significant values inside-outside, so they were fairly insignificant. The dredge-induced turbidity was minimal to negligible. That is, it was a short, very short distance within feet to a few hundred feet from the dredge that they experienced the resuspension, and they generally could not discern the difference between other things going on at the site, the background, and so on. So with all of this in mind, I think what happened was they decided that they really were not getting any bang for the buck, so they decided not to use silk curtains under these conditions. So we move now to B23, and here's what I like to do to summarize why curtains haven't worked, as opposed to which ones do work and why they work. Here's the ones the bullets that I think are important. Either they were not selected properly, they were not properly designed, or more than likely, not installed properly. They didn't have the right type of mooring, that is anchoring system, and perhaps even the deployment configuration, how they were put out, under what alignment, and they may have, in fact, been misaligned for the operation. You can usually find high currents where curtains have not been effective as well. Currents up to 1.5 or 2.5 feet per second are problematic, as it says here. can lead you to a situation where if you're in low currents, where silk curtains would work best, the turbidity is going to actually be localized. So therefore, why use a silk curtain? And if you're in the high currents, it's going to spread the turbidity, and they're going to be very difficult to maintain. So a lot of cases you see going from curtains to sheet pile with curtains inside them to try to isolate areas that are being dredged within the overall area of concern. High winds can take curtains and lift them out just like a sail. It can be very dramatic to see one of these happen. And then something that's not thought about, curtains are temporary solutions. They're not meant to be out year-round. In some cases where you leave curtains out, you can get very excessive biological growth, which in fact can weigh down curtains, particularly in marine environments. Now moving on to B24, things that are typical in terms of damage to curtains, seams get ripped, anchor lines are broken, you have ships or small boats that run into them, some of the tender boats that actually operate around a dredge can damage these with their prop washing net, floats are damaged, so on. You see them here, broken cables. But most extensive curtain failures that I've seen is where they lose whole sections, and that's a pretty bad situation when you lose the entire section of a curtain. And usually these can be during the high event times, say getting a flood flow through, routing a flood through a system. Now when you put out curtains and other types of controls such as sheet piles, you also must consider the impacts these might have on flood capability or flood carrying capacity of a stream, because you are isolating portion of that, particularly with the sheet pile, you're isolating a portion of that river flow off. You go to the next slide, B25, and you see that the effectiveness of curtains is very material specific. As I mentioned, it's the suspended material that you're concerned with, how you put it out there, whether it's full depth or partial depth, currents, fluctuating water levels, the storm events, seki events, wave heights, ship wakes, like Mike alluded to earlier, where a navigation project is adjacent to your cleanup project and you have ships moving through that can throw wakes and create some significant issues. And usually we're looking at site conditions where the water depth is not too deep, 20 feet or so. Operating on slopes is difficult, anchoring a curtain so that it will not leak on a slope situation, trying to anchor curtains where there's still perhaps some debris. All of these issues or site conditions can contribute to a not so successful curtain operation. So let's go to B26, which basically is, we call it, the bottom line. There is no one type of curtain that will solve all of your problems. They are very temporary in nature. They need to be selected very carefully and designed for their intended function, that is to control or water column suspensions. There's a lot of information that needs to be known about the site, and in many cases the manufacturer of a curtain is totally unaware of the actual application. Contractors in many cases will call up and order a certain amount of curtain, a certain type, and the actual manufacturer is just producing a length, number of panels, and so on for the operation. And then one last bullet, and I think this was an addition to the one I had in here earlier, where they should be budgeting for maintenance and repairs. Curtains, generally, when contractors bid a job that has silk curtains in it, a lot of times they'll bid not just the first curtain or the initial curtain that goes in, but a replacement curtain, because they know that somewhere along the line it's going to be perhaps ripped out or need to be replaced for a variety of reasons. If you go to the next slide, B27, Not everything is so bleak. We do know something about how to select and design curtains. Soap curtain guidance is available from the Corps of Engineers. Their Dredging Operations Environmental Research Program produced a technical note, this TNE2, which is available at the website shown there. And within this technical note that actually I wrote it with Mike Palermo and I wrote it, there's a lot of information on how to identify and select soap curtains and how to specify curtains. In fact, for your benefit, we've actually included a checklist that goes from the initial selection through all the way to the final installation, monitoring, deployment, and retrieval. And that's some of the issue you get into is in many cases you might have to not only deploy once, but many, many times if you're moving down a project of some considerable length. Now, let's move away a little from the resuspension R and talk a little more about the other two of releases or residuals. That's B28, and we'll skip through the schematic and go to the next slide. Mike actually covered this in a way for me. There are very few things you can do for residuals. He mentioned the additional cleanup passes, and he also mentioned the fact that some projects that have hard pan or rock bottoms are just very difficult. There's no way to get down in below that residual so that you can remove it by dredging so it remains. And so therefore you may have to do something else, perhaps a thin-layered cap material or some material that is clean that could be incorporated in the top, say, few inches, 6 inches or so, that would mix with those residuals or in some way to reduce their availability to the organisms that would reside there, and that would be one method of control. Obviously, another method would be a thicker cap, and this is what we covered in the last in the first internet training session last week. So you would go through the same evaluation and design that you would do for that type of operation. And that's pretty much what you have for residuals at this point. Perhaps you could incorporate some other things like carbon or some kind of organic material that would bind material and make it less bioavailable. If you had a cap that had some organic matter in it, that would serve that purpose. So you would look for a clean cap with some organics in it that would help bind up materials. Next, on B30, you have volatile issues, let's say materials that are released into the water column and that ultimately can be lost to the atmosphere. At the dredging site, there are very few things you could do. Perhaps try to cover the site. I'm not aware of any real measures that have been used for the at the dredging site itself. They're very, very contaminant and site-specific. During transport, we may see one or two of these where you could add some kind of cover or foaming material. In a pipeline, you have control, but then if there's gases that are produced, then you need to be concerned with the off-gassing when that is distributed or actually offloaded into a rehandling operation. And then when you are offloading, mechanically or hydraulically, you may have the similar issues. So we go to the next slide. Well, what can you do to control? Well, at the dredging site, we talk about slowing down, cutting back on the production rate, trying to release less material into the water column, capture more by the dredge. That's one method. That's a management tool that could be used. Overlapping dredging passes to minimize that resuspension is another thing. If you're concerned with oils, there are some dredge heads that have been developed to retain oil and get better capture. Of course, decreasing sweep speed for cutter heads. That's the side-to-side motion, the arc. And then, of course, I alluded to degassing a pipeline. And then finally, these are some foams. There are some commercial foams that are available that you can actually spray on perhaps in barges or on the material that is going to be dewatered later. And finally, there are some absorbent mats and materials that you could use perhaps as well. Again, adding to the difficulty of the overall control and retrieval. Now let's go to B-32. B-32, Mike talked about quality of life issues, such as noise and light. In the noise, primarily, here's what you can do. You can establish the decibel levels, which is normally done in ordinances, and you can't, let's say at night, exceed a certain level, certain decibel level, at a certain distance. This is what's normally done, or you can change your schedule so that you're not impacting a neighborhood. This was done, or has been done in a number of projects. Make sure that the mufflers and the dampening methods, any type of enclosure on your dredging operation, are in fact working properly, so that and any damaged mufflers would be replaced and so on. It's a little extreme, but on the right side you see a geotextile fabric that is used to dampen construction operation. This is a platform where they actually had some work going on. I'm not sure I've ever seen anyone hung on for a dredge, but perhaps a mechanical dredge if you've got problems there. But I'm not suggesting that's what to do. Light can become a problem if you're working at night and you happen to be shining a bright light into to a home. Need to reconsider that. Obviously, re-aim the light, just simple things. Shielding the light so that you reduce the amount of light that gets out of your work site. And then finally, for all of these, inform the public with monitoring information. Perhaps set up real-time websites, and I know this is done in a lot of projects where there's an interaction with the not only the regulatory community tracking the progress of a project, but also with the public sites that are available for people to see just what's being done and making sure that you are meeting your obligations. Now, if you go to B-33, let's talk about a couple of things that project managers perhaps should or shouldn't do. We should recognize the unique nature of these projects. Mike mentioned the site-specific, material-specific, equipment-specific, operator-specific. Well, all of those come into play, and they should be site-specific recognition of the need to adapt any and all of the control measures we talked about. So adaptive management is one of the things that we stress. I didn't hit on it too much, but there is a scar potential associated with structural controls such as sheet piles and cofferdams, where you perhaps are increasing the bottom velocities around these structures if you put them out into a river system that has a high current. Sheet piling can change the carrying capacity. I think I mentioned on that. Make things more temporary, susceptible to temporary flooding. Next slide, B-34. We should recognize that all dredging will have some type of resuspension that may or may not require some type of water column control, such as a silt curtain. It's a very site-specific type of determination. I do know that on the soluble releases, more recently on some of the pilot projects, we've seen some soluble releases, so that's perhaps going to get a little more scrutiny than it has in the past, right through the silt curtains. Select them only if there's been a careful evaluation and designed to meet and ensure that they meet the intended function. Obviously, Mike hit this other one. We got dredging is going to have residuals. It may or may not warrant some type of additional control. That will be an exposure assessment that will have to be done. Did you meet your CULs and or your overall goal? And then beware that we can create these quality of life issues. In one case, there may be more than just odors. It could be hydrogen sulfide in the case of New Bedford, which created a need to correct that issue because of a potential health hazard to workers and so on. And anytime you use controls, anytime you use any of these techniques, you're going to add to the time it takes to do your job. Now, let's shift away from controls now, and the rest of this talk will actually center in on the slide 35, so what, the rest of the story. Dredging is one component. Mike said that it must be compatible with all of the following or subsequent components, the staging and rehandling and treatment and disposal. And there's a common linkage. It's transportation. I give you some recent information that I was able to assess in relation to cost. Dredging and the excavation component, the removal part of it, may range from 10 to 20% of the overall cost of a remedial action that involves dredging. So as much as 80% could be incorporated in those latter three bullets, including transportation. So even though we're not going to provide a lot of information on these at this point, I will at least caution you that when you begin to select dredging, you must select the entire process train and consider it from beginning to end, because it won't work. Once you pull it up, you got to put it down somewhere. So let's go now to B36, which is the transportation considerations. Distance, primary consideration. Are you mechanically dredging and hauling it by barge miles away to an offloading site? Are you pipelining it by hydraulic dredge to a nearshore facility, and so on? What type of water content is going to be in that material that's being transported? Obviously, if it's a barge operation, it will be hopefully minimal water from perhaps mechanical dredging. Whereas hydraulic dredging, you're going to induce a lot more water. So just the nature of these techniques of dredging will influence the transportation technique. Not to say that you can't mechanically or hydraulically, hydraulically dredge into a barge. It can be done. It has been done. It does impact significantly the production rate and so on. And that's generally a special consideration for why they did that. Same way with mechanical. I've seen mechanical dredging with on barge slurring and transporting. That particular operation was done in a pilot study at New Bedford. The last pilot study was done there. One of the considerations, obviously, is if you're going to be re-slurring or in any kind of dredging hydraulically, you're concerned with debris, as Mike pointed out. Next slide is B37. Conveyors have been used at various projects. This is Lake Peoria that was dredged with a high concentration solid material that was our dredge type that was put into a conveyor and then rehandled and brought to its placement site. So they have been done, although this is not common. This is very uncommon. It wouldn't be done if you had a material that was subject to a lot of volatile releases, obviously. Next slide is 38. We're going from into the staging rehandling type of operation where we have transported it to a site that is being offloaded, and you must handle the debris, the sediment, the water. Could be subsequently dewatered, handled in a treatment, and then finally disposed of. But let's talk about the staging or rehandling component. If you go to the next slide, B39, this is out of the Highlight 6-8, out of the Sediment Remediation Guidance Document 2005, which merely illustrates the fact that in many cases you're going to need some temporary storage, most cases perhaps, onshore, where you're bringing the material either directly from a dredge into a, let's say, a CDF or some kind of basin containment area, or you're going to take it out of a barge and you're going to rehandle it at the site where you perhaps have dewatering going on. Then the water's got to be treated and returned to the waterway, and then the solids are going to be removed. But ultimately, there's some overall type of perhaps facility that would take and provide equalization. Because what happens, Mike mentioned that The dredge itself is generally not the stumbling block or the roadblock along the way in a lot of these process trains. It's the limitations of the stuff to the right of the dredge. That is the ability to the throughput capacity of the water treatment facility or the sludge rehandling facility, and even in some cases the ability to haul material off-site to a landfill if there are limited trucks, trains, and so on. Next slide, I'll just give you a few pictures of offloaders. This is a hydraulic offloader. It's a DOP unit. This is actually Dutra's plant at Yorktown, if I'm not mistaken. Where a barge comes in, you can see it's got water in it, surface water, but water also has to be added to get the material so it will slurry and then be transportable. If you go to the next slide, this is a Toyo pump that is actually also used, particularly in smaller projects, to rehandle material from a barge and pump it into a placement site or some type of rehandling. Barges can be compartmentalized, and you can actually go through some segregation of materials in barges. Next, B-42, we have the issue of screening and of debris and the problems associated with it. Can't stress enough that you're going to have debris, and the debris is going to cause you some issues. The slide on the left, it shows a grizzly bar screen where you actually, a bar screen where you're mechanically dropping material into it and it's being washed through. That's one way of doing it. On the right is that same DOP Dutra unit, which has a bar screen around the, or before you get to the pump. And if you go, and you can see some of the debris, if you go to the, and I think Mike talked about the debris, and that's going to slow down your production rates and so on. Also, debris like that does present a problem for workers. They got to get out. They got to get in contact with this type of material. So you got to be aware of the worker health issues associated with that when you're doing your plan. You go to the next slide. You're at B-43. You put it in a barge. You got to unload the barge. Well, when you finish unloading a barge, you might end up with a lot of stuff in that barge. Particularly in this case, this is some maple. This is creosote logs. If you look at the lower right-hand slide, that has to be removed. You've got to decon this equipment. So all of that needs to be taken into consideration. Obviously, the contractor would when he's bidding it, but you need to be sure that you recognize this because these are types of materials that are going to cause problems and difficulty of getting this out of a barge in many cases. Maybe it's not considered originally, and it's a lessons learned. So let's go now, and we'll briefly touch on, and starting with 44, the next slide, we're going to touch on treatment just briefly and mention in slide 45 that there are a number of advantages and why even consider treatment. Well, it's a Sarah preference. There are technologies available, and it seems to be popular, obviously, with people. Destroy it, get rid of it, great. However, if you go to the bottom set of bullets, you can see that the cost goes up dramatically. You have other issues to consider if you're bringing, let's say, in this case, an incinerator on site, which is not being done a lot. You've got emissions. If you're going to pre-treat, you're going to have to definitely condition the material and make sure that it is fed in at the appropriate rates, particularly to incinerators. You've got to meet moisture contents and so on. And then all of the residue streams, different type of residual here, the side streams, the waste streams, have to be managed, have to be permitted, and have to be obviously have to be acceptable for those releases and discharges. Or ultimate disposal. And then all of this presents another type of risk. If you go to the next slide, this is a schematic that shows a sequencing of operations in a classification dewatering facility. It's not really treatment other than it's pre-treatment, adding a polymer to condition the filter press. But if you start on the lower left-hand side, and go up, you're going into the mechanics of a clarifier. Over to the right, you can see sedimentation, an effluent that would be then further treated and discharged, and then that black sludge would be then brought to a filter press or a bench, some type of dewatering mechanical device, and then ultimately go out on the right side as a filter cake that would then be disposed of. The advantage of a classification system is that you can perhaps remove the larger particles, the large gravels and rocks and sticks and stones, if you will, and some of that can be clean material or at least can be elutriated to be a material that can perhaps go to a different type of disposal operation, subtitle D, as opposed to a C landfill, which reduces the cost. Now let's go to the final set of slides, B47, which we'll discuss disposal in a very quick way. Next slide, B48. We talk about confined disposal. This would be normally located close to the site. You can design these because they're monofills. Hopefully they could be permanent. Perhaps if you had the luxury of being able to be on the property that's being remediated, let's say adjacent to the waterway that's contaminated, and you might be able to have an on-site landfill. If not, then you could go to commercial, which is either trucked or railed to a permitted facility. If you come to the next slide, 49, this is one I've used to illustrate Point Mouillet, which is that Black Lagoon site was actually used a navigation disposal site. They had the luxury of being able to ship this material over to that site that was designed with a liner. So if you go starting with one, you have the material being dredged and put in the barge, barged over to the site. Ultimately, they trucked it. That's another story. They had an ice problem offloading. So that's something you need to consider, the conditions in which you're operating. They actually couldn't offload once they got with the barges later on into the winter season, so they had to start actually trucking the material around to the site. Three is the offloading at the site, and four is a lined facility that they're actually placing the material. And this site, with this material, they actually incorporated, a solidification product so that they could actually compact it in the site. And then the next slide, B50, permitted landfills. I don't have to get into much detail, but you see the subtitle C and D, TSCAs. Obviously, you must pass the appropriate test, whether it's tank filter or other types of testing. Many states do allow for monofills. That gives you some flexibility in designing something that might be a wet landfill. Usually requires dewatering solidification. You've got to be able to haul it. And then you're going to pay a price, obviously. And a rule of thumb, 1 ton per yard of fine grain dredge material, give you an idea about what it might cost. Next slide, B51, merely illustrates the fact that some cases on site or even at the site you go to, they may need a plug mill to mix the material up and then bring it in, compact it, bring it into layers. Although this is not a landfill, this is actually, I think it's Pennsylvania Mines, bar camp, I believe. But the fact is that you have to go through this operation, which adds cost and so on, but it's a necessary step. And then finally, be remiss if I didn't cover the entire universe, contained aquatic disposal, a CAD, on the last slide, B52. Subaqueous containment in a submerged confined site has been done. It's permitted under the Section 4401 portion of the Clean Water Act. You would use the same types of considerations that we talked about last week, where we were placing material in pits in the in-situ capping technologies. And if you go to the last slide, I think B53 is the last of the picture slides. It was done at one site, Puget Sound Naval Station. They had a couple of CAD pits where they actually disposed of contaminated material underwater. And there are some, there may be one or two other examples of that. Rotterdam Harbor used CAD cells for some very contaminated material in that harbor. Now, let's go to B-54, and I'll try to keep us on schedule and go through these last three sides just to give you a wrap-up. Lessons learned. The contaminated sediments are very unique, and that variability of these sediments, how they're dredged, the characteristics, the water contents, the variability in water or solids as it comes to the site will dictate in usually some type of attenuation or compensation for the, for these widely varying loading rates. So that may be a CDF or some kind of equalization facility. A lot of processes out there, but just emphasize that conventional wastewater treatment is just not plug and play. It needs to be very carefully evaluated and designed. We didn't have time to go into that today. Very complex trains create very expensive operations. And then finally, I think the last bullet is pretty consistent with what we see around the country. Treatments rarely used beyond dewatering and solidification. It's just not being done on site to a large degree. Might change with some of the mega sites coming online, but I'm not sure. Then finally, the next slide, project managers obviously should consider the compatibility of all the components of the process train. Can't emphasize that enough. You need to consider the risk of losing material along the way. The losses associated not only in the water column at the dredging site, but also during the transport, dewatering, storage, and treatment. We should be considering net risk reduction along of all of the processes that are associated with this, how we manage the overall risk. And then finally, there is a lot of difficulty I hit on in moving material from barges. You just need to consider there. You can't get 100% out very easily. You've got to go through some extended measures. And then the last slide, I believe this is the last slide, should consider the need to treat water prior to discharge, obviously. Water treatment cost estimates need to be included in the plan. You need to recognize all of these things. And then finally, there are risks associated not only to workers but to communities when you're out there transporting materials through the off the work site into perhaps a commercial fill. And then finally, the last slide, you know, all our great endeavors to control things, some things you just can't control. So I'll throw this back to Kelly, and Kelly, I hope I put this back into a reasonable time.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Norm, for that great presentation. So now we're going to open it up again, as Norm said, to the question and answer period. And before, as you unmute your lines and hit those buttons, I wanted to, again, for any materials such as EPA guidance and things of that nature, we do have, there is a page with a bunch of links that includes all the recent EPA documents related to this subject. That goes to a question that was submitted online. And so I guess I open it up for the folks on the phone for any questions to Norm. Comments? Out there?
Did the beeps mean that everybody left already?
No, we're still here.
We're still here, okay. Or was it just too perfectly clear? Clear as that turbidity out there.
Very clear, I think. That's the issue. Again, does anybody have any comments or questions for Norm on some of these? I guess one question I would have, the Norm.
Go for it.
You had mentioned treatment might be an option with these megasites. Is there any particular factor of why that is? Is it the economies of scale, or?
No, well, I would think for the long term economy of scale might be any. There might be some attractiveness, although I haven't looked at it myself. I haven't really looked at it in any detail. So I know that you know. Obviously, the rehandling of material, pretreatment, segregation, just depends the nature of the project as to whether or not there would be the economy of scale associated with such a thing.
Yeah. Do you think we're there as far as being able to reach action levels with these treatment facilities on some of these sediment sites, with contaminated sediments?
As far as treating them to an acceptable level, I know there is much information that we know about treating contaminated soils and highly contaminated soils. Mm-hmm. And as far as sediments go, you get it to a soil-like property, and then you apply the technologies. Can be done. It's just a matter of how much you're willing to pay. I mean, it's all cost-related. One issue, though, I will say, I mean, if you try to obviously site incinerators in certain locations, you can have significant resistance to that, public resistance.
Another question that we have online here, mm-hmm. Norm, is how effective are geotubes in dewatering sediment?
I didn't cover geotubes particularly. They can be effective. I know the Fox River, they're using it. They are not without their problems. It is a very material-specific type of application. You can do the test to evaluate their effectiveness, but once you get it in the tube, I think most of them require some type of conditioning of the material, such as a polymer to aid, a filtering aid, if you will. And they can be quite effective. The issue gets back to matching up the dewatering characteristics of the sediment with the dewatering ability of the mesh sizes and the geofabrics that you had selected. We're learning a lot more about that with projects like the Fox now. But we've had some experiences with that.
Okay. Is there anyone on the phone who has a question or comment? Again, offering that out. Is anyone? All right, then. Well, I...
Philly, I just want to reiterate, if anyone has information on silk curtain performance or any type of control measure performance, we would appreciate trying to get that. Case studies are it's hard to get that type of information out of some of the case studies because a lot of monitoring is just not done to establish the design requirements.
Okay. And again, your contact information is available on the site. So
thank you.
Correct that. So with that, I do again want to thank Mike Palmero and Norm Frasang for their providing the effort and also presenting the material today.
Quick
also
question?
Pardon?
Oh, quick question here.
Sure. I mean,
the draft guidance manual you referenced, is the are there criteria specified in there as goals? Or do you intend to address that?
Are you referring to the dredging technical draft guidance?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Mike. I'm still on the phone here. No, there's no specific number cited in the guidance or the technical resource document, depending on what we call it in the end. It's going to be a listing of the types of considerations that you might look at or a project manager might look at in setting the performance standards. We don't quote numbers.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, well then, with that, thanks Mike. I'd like to thank again the participants for being a part of this webcast. And as a reminder, next Monday concludes this series, October 30th, again at the same time. And that will focus on monitor natural recovery and monitoring. So we hope to see you again next week. With that, good night, and I hope everybody has a good evening. Thank you.